and that I have the opportunity to talk to real physicists after I left physics many years ago. And although I work on a machine learning department, I think there's still the physics behind the question that fascinates me. So the algorithmic Markov condition as a foundation of causal inference. And this is sort of a disclaimer. One may argue whether the topic of this talk is physics, but if not, I think it should become part of it, which may sound a bit bold, but I want to make this point. It is definitely not about quantum physics, but I invite the audience to think about its quantum generalization. Let's start with the motivation, correlation and causality. Recently, I read that children who visited a farm in their early childhood are less likely to get allergies. Of course, this raises a lot of causal questions that are highly relevant for our life. And many statistical observations raise causal questions. Sometimes people claim correlation says nothing about causality. But is this really true? I think it's not. According to Hans Reichenbach, physicist and philosopher, the statistical dependence between two variables x and y show either that x causes y causes x, or there's a third common cause influencing both. And in case two, Reichenbach postulated that x and y are statistically independent given z. So this symbol will always be used for statistical independence. And every statistical dependence is thus due to a causal relation. We also call two causal as opposed to some terminology in the literature. The distinction between these three cases is a key problem in scientific reasoning and the focus of this talk. First of all, I want to state the causal inference problem in its general form as considered in our causal inference community. Given n variables, x1 to xn, infer the causal structure among them from n tuples that are IID drawn from the joint distribution. And by causal structure, we mean a directed acyclic graph. And the arrow means direct influence. Without going into the philosophical discussion what causality means at that point, this is our language. And in order to formalize this a bit more, Perl introduced a so-called functional model of causality. And in a way, it contradicts what quantum theory says, but still for most things in everyday life, it's a reasonable model. So the model is that every node is deterministically influenced by its parents and an unobserved noise term. And so this is just a function of these terms. And so the noise terms are responsible for making the things deterministic. And then one assumes that all unobserved noise terms are statistically independent. This is actually just a matter of definition that all common causes needs to be explicitly modeled in this language. So noise that influences two nodes needs to be accounted for explicitly by a node, but unobserved noise terms influence each node independently. So the question is, what properties of the joint distribution follow from this model? There are four equivalent versions that are known in the graphical model community. First, the existence of such a model, okay, as I said. But the second, maybe the most intuitive implication, the causal, so the local Markov condition, saying that every node is statistically independent of its non-descendants given its parents. So this formalizes the fact that every information exchange with non-descendants involves the parents. Then there are a lot of conditional independences that follow from the local Markov condition, but in a quite indirect way, so they are not obvious. And to describe all these independences, we need the global Markov condition. So it describes explicitly via a graphical criterion called deseparation, which conditional independence follows from that one. And then we have the fourth condition, the factorization of the joint distribution into conditional distributions of each variable given its parents. And this is also an important representation because these things, these conditionals, the causal conditionals represent the causal mechanism in a sense. So you can factorize the joint distribution in many ways, but these are just mathematical decompositions. And we believe that this decomposition, where you write it in terms of its direct causes, has some physical reality. Yeah? Ah, okay, because the parents are also among these nodes xj. So the parentless nodes are included without loss of generality by making this parent set to the empty set. Okay, so the problem for causal inference from observational data is the following. Given a joint distribution, the Markov condition only describes which sets of DAGs are consistent with the joint distribution, but there are many DAGs consistent with the joint distribution, in particular, all the complete ones. So these are examples of the complete DAGs on three nodes, so they are compatible with any distribution. So in order to do causal inference, we need reasonable rules for preferring simple DAGs. And the most important one, which is widely accepted in the causal inference community, is causal faithfulness, saying prefer those DAGs for which the Markov condition implies every conditional independence that is observed. The idea is that generic choices of the parameters of these models yield faithful distributions. To show what this means, consider the following DAG. Let's say you observe that X is independent of Z. Then, if this was the true causal DAG, then the direct influence of X on Z and the indirect one via Y would have to compensate exactly. So this kind of unfaithfulness, so we have an independence that is not implied by the structure, is non-generic in the sense that it requires adjustments between parameters to ensure that this path compensates. And there are algorithms out there, PC and FCI, for instance, but a lot of variations of this, the same idea, that infer the causal structure just from conditional independences. Peter and Clark, the two inventors of this, and this is fast causal inference. So they have been invented in Pittsburgh at the CMU. Yeah, that's a big issue. I mean, the question of where your threshold is one of the most difficult questions. I mean, in practice, it's a question where many people work on how to decide.
Sorry, let me ask, is that an issue? Because if one has finite statistics, then you'll have...
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, all this, you can show that in the space of parameters, the unfaithful distributions have Lebesgue measure zero, but of course that doesn't apply when you have finite statistics, because you have to set the threshold somewhere. Okay, so the limitation of these methods, apart from the practical problems, there are fundamental limitations that many DAGs impose the same set of independences. For instance, this, this, and this one. We have X independent of Z given Y for all the three cases. We call them Markov equivalent DAGs, so they can't be distinguished by the Markov condition. And the method fails in particular if there are no conditional independences and they are unable to infer whether X causes Y or Y causes X for just two variables. And what we think is the problem that these methods only use yes-no decisions, conditional dependent or not, without accounting for the kind of dependencies. So in the community, it was generally accepted that this problem is unsolvable for just two variables, but that made it even more fascinating to try to solve it. And to give you a toy example why there is a lot of information in the joint distribution apart from conditional independences, consider the following example. Let X be a binary variable and Y real valued. Then you observe that Y is Gaussian and that X is equal to 1 above a certain threshold and 0 below it. Then you can easily imagine that Y causes X is a plausible model because it corresponds to a simple thresholding mechanism. So it's a machine where you put in a continuous variable as input, and the output is 0 or 1, depending on whether it's above the threshold or below it. What about the converse causal hypothesis, X causes Y? This requires a strange mechanism. So you think of a machine that has a continuous variable as output with this distribution, the gray one. If you have 0 as input and you get this distribution as output, if the input is 1, isn't that a strange mechanism? But there's also something else strange about this hypothesis. What happens if we change the input distribution? Then we get an output distribution that looks like that. So it seems that for this causal model, the input distribution of the cause and the conditional distribution of the effect given the cause seem to be adjusted to each other. So nature seems to know I have to use this input distribution in order to get a Gaussian output. So the general idea that will dominate this talk is we only accept the hypothesis X causes Y if P of X and P of Y given X look like independently chosen by nature. And what this means is a difficult question, but I will go into that. So the challenge reads, develop practical inference rules and algorithms that use this assumption for guessing whether X causes Y or Y causes X. I'm really careful, and I'm at that point, I don't want to say inferring. Maybe guessing is even more modest. Consider the following class of models. Let's say that Y is alpha times X plus noise with some noise that is statistically independent of X. And here it's important that we distinguish between statistically independent and uncorrelated. So uncorrelated here in our terminology would mean that only the expectations factorize, but independent means that the probabilities factorize. So you can always get uncorrelatedness just by least square regression, but you can't get necessarily independence. And there's a theorem that says whenever you have such a model in one direction, you can't have it in the converse direction unless the joint distribution is bivariate Gaussian. And a picture that visualizes this for a special case, let's say that X follows a uniform distribution on some interval, and the noise also follows a uniform distribution, different interval, then this diamond would be the joint distribution, the support of the joint distribution. While given that this would be the true model, the diamond would be placed like that. So, of course, this picture is only true for the uniform distribution, but in the more general case, it's just not possible to visualize. But there's a mathematical theorem that says it's either linear in one direction or in the other. Yeah? It's a noise term, an unobserved noise term. Yeah. Yeah, with X. Yeah. So you have a noise that's independent of X and not only uncorrelated.
Can I ask something on the general philosophy? You've assumed that every one of these, I don't know what you call these events, what do you call these X1, X, XY, Z? I just don't know for variables. Yeah, okay.
Variables.
These random variables. You assume that they all have distributions.
Yeah.
But some of the ones that people think about in physics, it's not clear that that's an appropriate.
Okay, we are talking about
because you
classical physics. Yeah.
No, I'm not worried about that. But, you know, like if you ask whether an EPR correlation or something in the Bell inequalities, you ask whether a particular setting here is correlated with a particular outcome here or something like that, influences. But the settings are normally not taken to have probability distributions. So is it important? I mean, that's the one that's, one that's thought about the most. Maybe.
Well, the experiments, they are determined randomly.
Well, they might be.
So, I mean, in practice, one uses a random number generator to generate measurement settings.
I mean,
but then suppose you didn't.
I mean, what does it mean whether something has a distribution? I mean, if I argue in terms of De Finetti theorems, then for me the question is not whether something has a definite distribution or whether I use definite distribution to describe it.
I mean, you could have two different, you have two different experiments, and they would use, even if they used a random number generator, they could use different.
Okay, so that's the regime where the distribution changes. That's what we don't consider here. So this is a restriction.
But I think that when you normally think about it, you don't need to even assume that there's a well-defined probability distribution for this setting.
Okay, but we assume it.
Yes, okay.
We assume
it. Maybe I could add that in that case, you might say the setting is chosen by some experimenter, you know, maybe adversarially or some other way. So there's sort of an intervention. And if you have variables on which you're intervening, it sort of helps you solve the problem of inferring the causal structure. So Dominic is solving a harder problem where you don't have people intervening on the variables, you only have the observed distribution, and are trying to infer the causal structure from that.
Okay.
But it's still correct, it's an assumption that we have a distribution, that we have IID.
The observed distribution might change with year because people change.
Sure.
That's
a different
how they'd like to do the experiment.
We don't consider that. Yeah. If recent work on problems that arise if probability distributions are changing, but that's not considered here. So we have a nonlinear generalization of that. Let's say y is a function of x plus some unobserved noise that is again statistically independent of the cause. Then there will, in the generic case, be no model that where x is the function of y plus an unobserved noise that is independent of y, even if the function is invertible. The proof is non-trivial. I don't want to go into that. Just want to give you the intuition. Okay, so if we have additive noise from x to y, then this imposes that the width of the noise is constant in x. So like here. But because of the function is nonlinear, the width of the noise won't be constant in y at the same time. So this heterostatic noise introduces dependence of the noise in the wrong direction. And a causal inference method that we have developed based on this insight is the following. Prefer the causal direction that can better be fit with an additive noise model. The implementation reads, compute the function f as nonlinear regression of y on x, compute the residual, just the error term, and then check whether e and x are statistically independent. And here it's important to have non-parametric statistically independence tests that can also account for higher order dependencies, not just correlations. And yeah?
Definition
of some? No. I mean, actually, in the mathematics literature, there's a clear distinction between uncorrelatedness and statistical independence for random variables. In the physical literature, people often talk about uncorrelated physical systems. And they mean something that we would call statistical independence. But this is justified because maybe. To clarify that point. Okay, so if the expectation of x, y is equal to expectation of x times expectation of y. So this is uncorrelatedness, but which is weaker than p of x, y is equal to p of x times p of y. But if you demand in addition that all functions of x and functions of y are uncorrelated, then this is equivalent to the statistical independent. And because the physics literature often talks about uncorrelated systems, it makes sense not to distinguish between those two things, because for a system you have the set of observables, and if they are all uncorrelated, it's also independent.
When one says a statistically independent system, it means a system with uncorrelated functions that is tested.
Yes, yes. In this sense, you can interpret it, and then it perfectly makes sense. Okay, and then we wanted to test this method on real data where we know what's cause and what's the effect. Here's the relation between the altitude and the temperature of places in Germany. So these are the points. Here's somewhere the Zugspitze, the highest mountain in Germany. So it's quite close to linear, but close to the sea, it's not linear. And if you run the experiment, then this is the error term that occurs when you regress the temperature on the altitude. And here's the error term that you obtain when you regress the altitude on the temperature. And what you may see is that here this is something quite natural, while this is some strange pattern. And in fact, it's true that the independence test detects strong dependence here, but except independence here. So the method correctly infers that altitude causes temperature. Okay, so here you have some pattern that shows it's not that obvious, but if if you change the temperature, then you get a different distribution of the residuals. So here you get such a distribution like that. Here at this temperature, you get a distribution that is more located in this point. So, I mean, it's hard to really to see visually, but the dependence tests really show that this is close to independence and this is not. Yeah? It's a so-called kernel method that maps the data into an infinite dimensional feature space. And in this infinite dimensional space, you can observe every statistical dependence as correlation. And this is one of the more recent developments also in machine learning, this kind of tests. Don't want to go to the details.
And it gives like a different. Could you translate like this is a three sigma effect, or
What do you mean by three sigma?
Well, I'm just using a physics language. I mean, how much worse is it? Suppose you assume that the altitude causes temperature, and then you assume, on the other hand, temperature causes altitude. How much worse is the?
The significance. I don't have the significance values here. I mean,
but they can be
I can't show you. We have computed them. We have them in the papers. Right? Yeah. We've compared the significance.
I'm sorry, I missed the point from the last slide. Does this work specifically when you assume a linear relationship between?
No, a nonlinear with additive noise. Yeah. That was this method. Huh? Mm. This method, nonlinear with additive noise.
Good.
Okay.
Coming, one last question about this. So the residual is meant to be the correct causal direction, the error. So you're really asking whether that distribution is a product of probability distributions for the axis and the error.
Yeah.
And so if that one on the right-hand side had a slightly, it wasn't totally straight, but had a slight slope, then it would be a product distribution. Because as it stands, it looks like it could be just a narrow Gaussian along temperature and a broad Gaussian along error. But if it had some slope, then it wouldn't be a product. So am I understanding correctly that that's the test you're doing, whether we can model this as being sampled from a product distribution?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what the method's doing. Okay, so... we collected 70 cause-effect pairs where we believe the ground truth is pretty clear. We got about 70% correct decisions, which is already statistically significant, but the fraction goes even better if we allow no decision. So it depends on how you set the significance thresholds. I mean, then in many cases, we would reject an additive noise model in both directions, and then we just don't decide. And I think this is very important, this conservative decision, because we do not claim that noise is always additive in real life. That's not the point, but we think that if it is additive for one direction, this is unlikely to be the wrong one. And why we think that this is true is... again, connected with the independence principle I mentioned. So let's say that the joint distribution admits an additive noise model from X to Y. Then the distribution P of Y and the conditional P of X given Y satisfy this differential equation. I don't want to discuss this equation in detail, but in a way it shows that it's unlikely to have this if P of Y and P of X given Y are chosen independently. We have tried to make this statement more precise in a longer paper. Okay, so it's again the ideal. Nature chooses the distribution of the cause and the conditional distribution of the effect given the cause independently. And here, for the wrong direction, there seem to be a mutual adjustment, so we don't accept this hypothesis.
So is that the log p of x given x, or what, that equation there, the last term?
Yes, that's a typo, x given y.
Okay.
Yeah, just the relation between p of y and p of x given y. Thanks. Okay, but employing properties of the noise is not the only way of inferring causal directions. Look at the noiseless case. So we observe that y is a function of x, and that x is just the inverse function of y. And we want to know whether this or this is the right causal model. And we are again motivated by the idea, if x causes y, then the function and the density p of x, the distribution p of x, are chosen independently by nature. And what this means here is that the peaks of x don't correlate with the slope of x, the slope of f. What does it imply? So assume you have some fluctuations of the distribution here, and here you have different slope of x, then you can easily see that in the region where f is flat, you get peaks of the output distribution. And of course, you still get fluctuations from the distribution that stem from the fluctuations of the input. So what you observe if you consider the backwards model, so let's say this would be the cause and this the mechanism, then it seems that the peaks of the cause are adjusted to the regions where the inverse function is steep. So this is what makes the backwards hypothesis unlikely.
If you perform a change of the backwards, you could make a flat distribution.
Yeah, that's not allowed. I mean, in this, that's an important issue. Here, it really depends on how you represent the data, but that's quite common in machine learning, that everything depends on in which framework coordinate system you phrase your problem. And I think that can't really get around. We can't really get around that. So it implicitly assumes there's a kind of natural representation for the data. And this can be made more explicit, I'm afraid, would be running out of time. So there's a postulate that phrases this uncorrelatedness in mathematical terms. And we defined an inference rule out of it. It says roughly the following principle. The entropy of the output distribution so should be equal to the entropy of the input distribution plus the entropy of the output distribution that you get when you plug in the uniform distribution into the function. So here, entropy of output is equal to entropy of input plus entropy of image of uniform distribution under the function. So this condition is an implication of the independentness of the slope of the function and the input distribution. We derived a testable implication and inferred the causal direction just by comparing some expressions, just by comparing some entropy expressions. If we have time, I can go more to the details, but I think it doesn't make sense here. We applied this to real-world data. Here we obtained about 78% correct decisions if we decide in all cases. when we had huge databases with water levels at 22 cities at the German River Rhine. So here, this is Rhine. We picked two random pairs in this set of cities and decide which one is upstream and which one is downstream. And then the algorithm obtained about 87% correct decisions. Here's a comparison of the methods that I don't want to go into. So we collected a lot of data from different domains in real life, biology, meteorology, and economy, and want to evaluate our methods. Okay, so now I'm getting a bit more close to the physics part of this talk. So we have observed that empirical distributions are often asymmetric with respect to swapping cause and effect. The question is, how does this relate to the error of time? To explain that, I describe an experiment that a colleague of mine did with very interesting results. Observe the following error of time in stationary stochastic processes. So first, my colleague showed the following theorem. If a time series has an autoregressive model, xt is equal to a linear combination of the past values plus an independent noise term, then there is no such autoregressive model for the backwards time process until the noise is Gaussian or the coefficients vanish, so the trivial part. Which means that a linear autoregressive model can only exist in one time direction if the noise is non-Gaussian. And then we created the following experiment. So we, yeah?
What if the noise is Gaussian? Does it mean that there will exist?
Then there exists one in both directions, yeah.
I see. Okay. So Gaussian is the most common kind of noise.
Yeah, but no, I don't agree. I think it's just the common assumption, but I don't think that there are that many Gaussian processes. Okay, so usually, I think in the most data sets that we considered, the tails were longer than in Gaussians, and then you can have only one direction. So the question is, can we infer the true time direction by this observation? And we considered time series from finance and from EEG data. And the result was that the models were significantly more often linear in forward direction than in backwards direction. And this smells a bit like an error of time. And to show the connection of this asymmetry to the usual error of time, I want to show you a physical toy model that I published in the Journal of Statistical Physics. So let's say your measurements xt are physical observables of a fixed system S at time t. And then, okay, so you measure the system every time, and then the noise term is provided by propagating particle beam here from the left to the right. So we have these particles. And once the particles reach the system, they interact and disappear to infinity. Okay, what are the assumptions in this model? Maybe go back to this. So here I assume a linear interaction, so a linear transformation of the physical space state space of these models, of these systems. And then I assume that the particles are statistically independent when they come in. But of course, due to this interaction, they will leave the system with statistical dependencies. And except for Gaussian states. So this is, again, important non-Gaussianity. And then this is a point maybe it's always a bit delicate to use the term entropy in the context of thermodynamics. But to make my statement careful enough, so if all these particles are statistically independent before they approach the system, and they are dependent afterwards, and we know that the entire process is entropy conserving in terms of Shannon entropy conserving, and we defined a kind of coarse-grained entropy of the outgoing particles by the sum of the individual entropies, then we can say this coarse-grained entropy increases by this process, because they are dependent, the particles. So one can show that this model generates a linear transition matrix in forwards time direction, but a nonlinear one in backwards time direction. So this is the asymmetry. And the question is, why is the time reversed process unlikely? So the incoming particles would be statistically dependent, and the interaction with the system S would remove the dependencies, and the outgoing particles would be independent. And okay, so what makes this scenario unlikely is not that the incoming particles are dependent. Of course, that can occur all the time, but the thing is that they interact with the system in a way that removes the dependencies exactly in a reversible process. So the rotation angle of, maybe go back to this transformation, the rotation angle of this transformation needs to be adapted to the kind of dependencies that the dependent particles have when they arrive. So the model requires adjustments between the incoming state and the rotation angle. Note the following analogy. The input states of the particles and the mechanism transforming the state are independently chosen by nature, which smells a bit like our assumption P of cause and P of effect given cause are independently chosen by nature. But of course, this has to be made more precise. And a formalization of independence has been provided by Lemaire and Dirks in 2006 and further elaborated on it by us. It says the shortest description of P of cause effect is given by separate descriptions of P of cause and P of effect given cause, which means that P of cause and P of effect given cause contain no algorithmic information about each other. But the question is, what has description length to do with causality? And in order to describe that, we want to forget about statistics for a moment and ask, how do we draw causal conclusions in real life?
By measuring length, are you talking about in terms of complexity? Or what is your measure there?
That's what I'm going to tell now. So these two objects are similar, and we want to have an explanation. Why are they so similar? Obvious explanation is that they come from the same factory. But we agree that such similarities require an explanation. question is, what kind of similarities require an explanation? Consider we observe those two t-shirts. Here we would not assume that anyone has copied the design because the design is just too obvious. This shows that similarities require an explanation only if the pattern is sufficiently complex. To show a more formal example, let's say two persons are instructed to write down a string with thousands of digits. And then the result is that both choose the same binary sequence. So all 1,000 digits coincide. The naive statistician would conclude there must be an agreement between the subjects because they are perfectly correlated, the output. He would reject statistical independence and infer the existence of a causal relation. However, a clever one could recognize that this is just the binary expansion of pi. So after observing this, it could be that the subjects may have come up with this number independently because it follows from a simple law. This is supposed to show that superficially strong similarities are not necessarily significant if the pattern is too simple. But how do we measure simplicity versus complexity of pattern and objects? We've decided to use Kolmogorov complexity. So the Kolmogorov complexity of a binary string is defined as the length of the shortest program with output x. And the interpretation is it's the number of bits required to describe the rule that generates x. I don't want to go into that. So usually we have equalities only up to constants and show this by this sign. One can show that k of x is uncomputable, so there can't be an algorithm that computes it. It describes a probability-free definition of information content. And what we also will need is conditional Kolmogorov complexity. So k of y given x is the length of the shortest program that generates y from the input x. And it's the number of bits required for describing y if x is given. So there's some subtlety. K of y given x star is the length of the shortest program that generates y from x star, which is the shortest compression of x. And the subtle difference is because x can be generated from its shortest compression, but not vice versa, because there's no algorithmic way to find the shortest compression. We need the notion of algorithmic mutual information, information of x about y, which is defined of as k of x plus k of y minus k of xy. So this is intuitively the number of bits that you save when you compress x and y jointly instead of compressing them independently. So here's the joint compression, these are the independent compressions. This is an example. If you want to compress this and this jointly, then this is the amount of information that you save. And there's a nice analogy to statistics. If you replace strings with random variables x, y, and replace Kolmogorov complexity with Chen entropy, and replace the algorithmic mutual information with statistical mutual information, phrased in terms of Chen entropies, then you end up with the same equations. And we have postulated the following principle. If two strings x and y are algorithmically dependent, then either x causes y, or y causes x, or there's a third common cause. So every algorithmic dependence is due to a causal relation. So it's supposed to be the algorithmic analog to Reichenbach's principle of the common cause. And of course, the distinction between three cases requires conditional independences on more than two objects, as in the statistical case. And to this end, we also consider conditional algorithmic mutual information. How much time do I have?
Okay. We have time for a couple of questions.
Yeah, okay. So this is in strong analogy to the statistical case. We can define conditional independence. Then we define what we call an algorithmic model of causality that reads as follows. So it's important that our nodes are now not random variables, but just objects, so strings that formalize objects. And here, in this model, every string is computed from its parents, the direct causes, via some program EJ. And the EJ represents the description of the causal mechanisms. And then we assume that those programs EJ are algorithmically independent, and they are the analog of the noise terms in the statistical functional model that I presented. And then one can show that we have three versions of the Markov condition that follow in analogy to the statistical case. So we have the local version. So given its direct causes, every xj is conditionally independent of its non-effects. The global version in terms of deseparation, and a recursion formula that the joint complexity is a sum of the conditional complexities of every object given its direct causes. Okay, and what we derive from it is given that nature chooses P of cause and P of effect given cause independently, then they are also algorithmically independent because we have postulated that there are no algorithmic dependencies without causal connections. And the question that that fascinates me is the algorithmic independence between initial state and dynamics of a system also at the heart of the thermodynamic era of time? If you remember the toy model with the incoming beam, where I said a crucial point in this asymmetry was that the transformation and the state of the incoming particles are chosen independently. Because if you reverse the scenario, you would need these dependencies. And the challenge is to deeper understand the relation between causality, thermodynamics, and algorithmic information. Thanks for your attention. Sorry, I realized that it was maybe a bit too long, but...
We have some time for some questions.
Yeah?
Yeah, I mean, so on your very last suggestion, this requires you to think of nature choosing a dynamical law at random. So, you said before that the issue is what's the prior, but I don't even, in this case, I don't even know what the range of the, I mean, it's not only a question about the prior, but what laws are you averaging over?
Well, I mean, if you think of this dynamics just as a simple one that is directly given by the laws of physics, then I think that my idea doesn't make sense. If, on the other hand, you think of the dynamics under consideration as being the restriction of a joint dynamics of a complex system to a subsystem, then it heavily depends on the state of the rest of the system. And then you can think of this state being independent of the state of the incoming particles.
Yes, that I think that sounds very plausible, but when we think of the thermodynamic era of time, we normally attach it to some cosmological initial condition, or else you put some fundamental time irreversibility into the theory. So when it's a question of if you believe that this era always can be traced back to the cosmological initial conditions, then all your examples of the subsystem, they would be consequences, but they wouldn't be the direct, primary expression of the era. It would be the cosmological initial conditions. And then it becomes very unclear what class of theories you're talking about.
Maybe that's a longer discussion. I'm not saying that I already made up my mind about that. And I don't really know if have profound knowledge about cosmology in order to answer that question. But if you think of, let's say, a billiard table and some billiard balls, and if you think of, let's say, the scaling of the table be independently chosen of the initial states, the initial momenta of your billiard balls, then you have a kind of independence of dynamics and conditions. Okay, but of course that doesn't apply for cosmology. I don't know. Yeah. But I would like to hear your opinion about that later.
So when you're talking at the end about the analogies between the standard causal discovery algorithms and ones that you build based on algorithmic dependence rather than statistical dependence, I was a bit surprised because the algorithmic information gives you a new handle on causal structure that you didn't have in the case of statistics. That even for two nodes, you can say something about the direction of the arrow by asking whether P of X is algorithmically independent of P of Y given X, or vice versa with the X and the Y. And so I thought, for example, that for the case of the simple three-node Markov chain, you would just forget about looking at, you could look at the independences, but you could also say, let's take the two nodes X and Y, factorize them as P of X and P of Y given X, also factorize them as P of Y and P of X given Y, test for algorithmic dependence. If one of them is dependent, the other is independent, then you know it's a direct cause. If you get dependence for both decomposition, they say it must be a common cause. So now you distinguish the three cases in that way rather than...
That's right, but the deeper reason why you can distinguish just between two variables is that the case of two variables is actually the case of many objects. So if you think of x1 and let's say to xn as samples from the same probability distribution corresponding to a single random variable x, and likewise y, then when you talk about this case, x causing y or y causing x, then it's actually a relation between all these observations. And therefore, the fact that we have more than two observations introduces the asymmetry then. That's what this algorithmic independence between P of X and P of Y given X amounts to is actually analyzing algorithmic dependencies between all these samples.
But you're saying that's different? Couldn't you have said that same thing in the other case?
That makes the analogy clearer, because then...
Rob is suggesting that maybe you have another criterion that works in the algorithmic case.
Okay, so in the statistical setting, this problem is unsolvable. we can solve it because for us, this case is not the two node case, it is the 2n node case.
But you don't have algorithmic complexities for x1, x2, x3, isn't it? It's just
you
the whole sequence that.
That
has the algorithmic.
Oh, no. Okay. It depends on the range of the variable. I mean, if these are continuous variables, then and you discretize them fine enough, then the single value already contains a lot of algorithmic information.
Let's say they were just bits.
If it's just,
if they were just individual bits. Just
okay, then you have to then you have to merge some of them. I've analyzed this in the paper. This is a longer story. So, but still, also if they are bits, we have shown that we get an asymmetry and can, in principle, infer the causal direction.
So this means that, so I think I understand what you're doing, but it means that your tricks for defining causal structure in the larger diagram using algorithmic information can lead to new methods of inference back at the statistical level by studying
yep.
the algorithmic information content of the
yep.
distributions. And have you formalized sort of the new rules that emerge by doing this? I mean, is there some simple way of...
Yes. If you define... let's say you have, you divide your observations into two parts. And then let's call this x1. Y1, X2, Y2, then one can show that Y2 should be conditionally independent of X1 given X2. And this is an independence that is asymmetric with respect to swapping X and Y.
Is there any other question? You have one? If not, let's
thank you.